Before we get started with the podcast you're about to listen to, we wanted to update you on the Montana lawsuit concerning gray wolves that was filed by Wild Earth Guardians and by Project Coyote earlier in November. On November 29th, the Montana State Court denied a preliminary injunction request to significantly curb wolf hunting and trapping methods and quotas in Montana until the merits of a lawsuit from two conservation groups can be heard. That means that Montana's efforts to kill 456 wolves, nearly 40% of the state's entire wolf population, based on potentially unsound modeling during the 2022-2023 hunting and trapping season, move forward unabated. Here are some words from Lizzie Pennock. She is the carnivore coexistence advocate for Wild Earth Guardians. She says, and I quote, "I knew it was a long shot, but I am disappointed and just plain sad that snares will litter the landscape starting tomorrow and more wolves will die while we continue to litigate our case. I am heartened by many pieces of the judge's order, however. The state suggested all day that putting out annual reports prepared mostly internally by FWP staff was a review of the wolf plan, which we totally disagree with, and so did the judge. He also noted that we raised legitimate policy objections to the use of snares, but that his hands are tied because the legislature mandated snaring. However, getting a preliminary injunction means that we would have to have showed that we would be irreparably harmed in the near future, which the judge just didn't agree with. He agreed with FWP that even if we hit the 450 quota this year, it would not reduce the population to an unsustainable level, and he didn't think we definitely showed at this stage that IPOM so overestimated the population that we would be looking at population-wide harm this season. We are hopeful for a win on the merits. I hope that the wolf season this year does not achieve the legislature's hopes of eradicating the population. For more information on the case as it unfolds, please follow Wild Earth Guardians, Project Coyote, and Wolves of the Rockies on their social media platforms and on their websites to get more updated information on the case as it continues to be litigated in court and ultimately resolved in the months to come. Thank you all for listening to this brief update on Wolf News, and now on with the podcast. There are multiple ways to keep in touch with the Wolf Connection podcast through our Instagram handle, the Wolf Connection Pod. And for comments and questions, send us an email to podcast@wolfconnection.org with your comments, questions, and guest ideas for Stephen and myself. You may hear your question answered on an upcoming podcast. Thank you for your support and howls to you all. Welcome to the Wolf Connection podcast. I'm your host, John Calfin. Let's talk about some more. All right, Stephen and I have another very important guest. We haven't really touched on Wyoming wolves, so this person I think is a good start for right now. She is the executive director of the Wyoming Wildlife Advocates since roughly 2019. She's coming to us from Victor, Idaho. She is Kristen Combs. Kristen, it's so nice to have you. Thanks for making the time. How's everything going over there?
It's going great. Thanks so much for having me today. I'm excited to talk about wolves in Wyoming.
Yeah, no, we haven't really touched on this state, and it's good. I think we both read your letter to the editor back in roughly September, and obviously a lot more things have been coming to the forefront, both in Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. So there's been a lot of wolf discussion. So this is all the stuff has been at the forefront. But I always like to figure out, or we like to ask, how did you get involved? I know before we were chatting here, you were a middle school teacher prior to, I think, joining this organization. So what sort of led you down this path of wildlife advocacy and switching gears from teaching to advocacy?
Yeah, I have always loved animals. It's, you know, other people and kids had dolls, I guess, other people did. And I always had like a million stuffed animals. And animals have always been a really big part of my life. And just... I am just somebody that has, my life has just revolved around animals, and I knew that I wanted to help them somehow as a career, and kind of started out, you know, just getting a general environmental science degree. I knew that would sort of take me down the right path with biology, and then, ended up with education being a big part of, sort of the first part of my career. And I started out at the Teton Science Schools, which is an environmental education center in Jackson, and just really fell in love with teaching and education and how important it is to get the next generation of kids, you know, involved in thinking about wildlife conservation and just, you know, being aware of what's going on out there. So, so it kind of just rolled into education. And I knew that I was having like an impact, you know, as a teacher on kids. And I did talk a lot about wolves and grizzly bears during that time that I taught. And I just, you know, didn't feel like I was having like as direct of a connection. And so I, you know, some positions came open in the field of advocacy, and I feel like that is just kind of where I'm meant to be, and just kind of dropped in there and have been hit the ground running since. So I guess this is probably my like seventh year of advocacy work. And yeah, it's never boring, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, there's always something going on. How can you bring some of the strengths you had as a teacher? Because clearly you were already talking about this, these types of issues, these types of this type of wildlife. What are the strengths that you used as a teacher now into the advocacy part?
Sure. I think that the biggest factor that comes into play here is just making science and some of these like complex topics more accessible to people. You know, it's something that like a lot of people just don't think about or maybe have as intimate of a connection to when it comes to biology and ecology. And so I try to just make, you know, break it down to its basis limit and just try and talk about some of the, you know, what makes things work in nature and the biology and some of the research that's going on behind some of these issues, and just bring that to people in a easy to understand format so that they can understand more about it and don't have to, you know, spend 10 minutes reading a scientific paper to understand what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way to approach it. And I think obviously I'm sure you can see the transition from kids and young adults and then trying to translate that to adults who have their feelings and their beliefs and their emotions, everything behind whatever they believe. What's your tact? I know you said you just sort of make it easier for them to understand, but what are some ways that you really sort of make it that you're not trying to necessarily change minds, but you're just saying, here's the information, here's how we lay it out, so that it's not necessarily an attack on what someone believes or thinks?
Yeah, adults are much more difficult than children. Kids are just sort of naturally open to, you know, learning new things and, you know, sort of like looking at the world in a different way. And adults are very much like set in their ways about their values and the things they perceive in the world. And so it is a difficult task that we have in front of us. And, you know, I think sometimes like you just have to know that you're not going to change people's values. You can introduce different ways of thinking to them, and you can try and sort of make it so that they at least can understand like a different side of what they feel. But, you know, ultimately people are coming from a place of values, and that is very difficult to, that's just a difficult place to change, because that's so much of like the fabric of who we are as a person that it takes a lot of time. And I still think that we have a lot of hope in the new generation of people that are coming up and moving into, you know, different positions, both in the government and private sector. And that is what is really going to like drive change down the road.
Yeah, I think patience is such a valuable tool to have. But again, you've had it in your prior work, and obviously it carries over to this. So that's clearly a tool that you have. That there's probably most folks in the world are probably saying patience is not one of my strengths, and you already have it.
It takes an incredible amount of
so,
patience. That's for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine. So what drew you to Wyoming Wildlife Advocates, and just briefly go over what their mission is too, because there's a lot of advocacy groups out there. What makes WWA a little bit different? Obviously, it's because it's in the state of Wyoming, but how you got there, and then what's the main mission, the main driver for the org?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, like I said, I was a teaching school, and an advocacy position came open in another organization, and I took that and was there for 2 years, and then kind of wanted to switch gears a little bit and focus on some broader issues. That was a very narrow scope of things. And Wyoming Wildlife Advocates is really, the focus of the mission is on like biodiversity and creating healthy ecosystems through biodiversity and sort of looking at things on more of a system level. And we do that through the lens of wolves, grizzly bears, and elk, which are three really valuable and keystone species in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Those three species are just everything to this place, and both culturally and ecologically, so and economically. I mean, those three species alone provide most of the backbone of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and the ecological processes that are played out here, and also, you know, biodiversity. And we're kind of different in here in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem than other parts of the country and the world, in that we have a surplus of wildlife and we have a suite of predators and prey that were here, you know, before European settlement. And that brings with its own set of problems of, like, you know, we don't have this like issue of scarcity that most of the country is looking at. Although when we come to something like bears and wolves, we do see that there's an incomplete picture there. And so the mission is for us is to just make sure that these natural processes are able to play out so that we do have a good suite of biodiversity and ecological systems that are functioning.
And on the topic of the mission, describe what it means to modernize wildlife management.
Sure. So we are a member of a coalition called Wildlife for All, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But basically, this is a nationwide effort to bring wildlife management into the 21st century. We're still using mostly, you know, really outdated science and outdated management tools that are not really, you know, we know they don't work anymore. We know that these are things that are, you know, focusing on one species rather than the whole entire ecosystem, or just having a surplus for hunting is not looking at systems as a whole and thinking about how do we balance those out, rather than, you know, do we just want to have enough of this species to hunt versus how is this animal actually beneficial to the ecosystem and creating more habitat and opportunities for other species to exist?
Because we had this discussion too, Lizzie Pennock was, when we were talking about Wild Earth Guardians, and they said the same thing about that. Some of these plans, and when we were talking about Montana, haven't been updated or looked at in 20 years, which, to think about any type of management style, you know, you really need to sort of look at the book. 2 decades is really a long time to not look at anything. So what are the main issues that you guys see in Wyoming? Because we obviously bear elk and people, I think, whether they understand it or not, that like that Yellowstone National Park, most of it is in the Wyoming side. I think there's like the very tip top is in Montana. Mm-hmm. So most of it's in Wyoming. So what are the main issues that you guys are seeing? I know you do a lot of grizzly bear work, and I know that's going to be coming down the pike even more because they're trying to delist them as well. So when we're talking about those three species, what are the issues that are happening for all three of them that sort of coincide together, and why it's such a important part for you guys to modernize this advocacy and this management situation for them?
Yeah, Yellowstone is a very much an island within Wyoming and is unique in how species are managed there. And the minute you set foot across the border into the rest of the state, you're looking at a very different situation. And, you know, it's such a juxtaposition of like Yellowstone is this really healthy ecosystem where we have like a good amount of wolves and elk. And, you know, there's just like this balance that's going on, and we're seeing all this recovery happen. And then literally, you know, you look at a place like Sheridan or Buffalo, Wyoming, and the ecosystems there are very much out of balance and very unhealthy, especially in places like Lander and Riverton and Rawlins. And so elk are such an iconic species, both in Jackson and throughout Wyoming. Elk hunting is a very big industry here, and it's very much part of the culture. Elk in general are just a very important species to the people of Wyoming. Consequently, you have, you know, grizzly bears and wolves, these apex predators that are so very important to coexisting with the elk herds. I mean, these are species that have co-evolved alongside each other for millennia, and we have just come in and totally upset that balance. And so the reason that they, you know, that this is such a contentious issue is because a lot of it is the intersection of elk and how grizzly bears and wolves are infecting the elk population. For instance, in the Grovant Mountains, right outside of Grand Teton National Park to the east, we were starting to see a recovery when wolves were listed as endangered. We were starting to see recovery of wolf populations, and you know, you can actually go out and see wolves during times of the year. And the wolves were pushing around the elk and making them move to different areas because that's what they're supposed to do. That's like, you know, that's how they co-evolved. That's the way that they should be functioning. However, once outfitters no longer had this steady supply of elk there that they could rely on to take hunters to, you know, hunt, and we're talking like, these are big bucks. An elk hunt is anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000. So we're talking a lot of money here for outfitters. And once elk started moving around because the wolves were, you know, looking for food and keeping them on the move, immediately, you know, the minute the Endangered Species Act protections were lifted, we started seeing, you know, just the quotas of wolf hunting went up there exponentially. And we no longer have a good population of wolves in the Grovants anymore. And you can't see them anymore.
So how do locals feel? You mentioned places like Lander and Riverton, the ecosystems being out of balance there in comparison, at least to interior Yellowstone. Are the locals there on the same page, or would they have a different viewpoint if you'd asked them?
I think one of the hardest things is that people just have an inherently trusting attitude about wildlife managers. Like people don't know enough about wildlife management to know that there are these nuances and that there's different ways of doing things and that we have new research that we didn't have 20 or 30 years ago that we should be looking at to make our management plans. And so I think, you know, there's surveys that have come out like, you know, how good do you think of a job of the Wyoming Game and Fish is doing? And people are like, yeah,
really?
They seem like they're doing, you know, they know what they're doing. Okay. And like the biologists are like, yeah, they're like, you know, they're the experts. Leave it to the experts. Right. They know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And that is just like, there's just this huge gap of what the public knows versus what is actually happening. Mm. And so that is probably one of the biggest problems in Wyoming is that people are just uninformed. These old cultural myths and, you know, things that surround wolves are just so ingrained into the culture here. So if you went to a place like Lander's a little bit different. It's kind of like a extension of Jackson. I don't know how much people know about Wyoming, but Jackson Hole is very much not a part of the rest of Wyoming. Teton County is the only blue county in a very red state. Down toward where Laramie is, it's a little bit purplish down there, but because of the university. But for the most part, it's a red state, and people are very much entrenched into there's this rugged individualism, you know, kind of attitude that exists here. However, Wyoming does receive an enormous amount of federal aid. And so, like, you know, a lot of these issues are about Wyoming as a state versus federal control. And that is, wolves really do embody that argument. Like that is like the crux of why so many people are just, you know, don't have a favorable view of wolves here, because there's this state's rights versus federal, you know, the federal government coming in and doing this thing to them. And there's also like, all these myths about, like, you know, wolves decimate the elk population, and elk hunting here in Wyoming is almost better than it ever has been. The success rate is huge. It's like greater than 40%, which is unheard of in most places.
Yeah. Do you know how Wyoming outlines the sort of the distinction between trophy game management areas and predator zones? Or why are those distinctions even drawn at all?
Yeah, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, before wolves were delisted, tried to prevent that from happening. It eventually went to court, and part of the settlement was that Wyoming got what they wanted. They originally denied the plan that Wyoming had set out, saying that it wasn't sufficient enough, and that's why wolves were not delisted at the same time that Idaho and Montana were. So as part of this settlement, the state of Wyoming got what they wanted, and so in and around Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Park, kind of like between Yellowstone and Cody, and then if you go south, kind of between Grand Teton and Pinedale, that area, that northwest corner of the state, is considered the trophy game management area. And so wolves have a hunting season there that goes from September 15th to December 31st. There is one region that extends to March 31st. There's another region that is a little different. It's like wolves are listed as predators part of the year and then as trophy game the rest of the year. And the entire rest of the state, so that's only like 15% of the state, you know, it's a very small portion. The entire rest of the state, they are listed as predators. And basically, our wildlife management agency does not manage them there. The Department of Agriculture manages them there. And so they're in the same category as coyotes, raccoons, foxes, skunks. What are the other animals? It's like stray cat and porcupine.
Okay.
And jackrabbits are also in this category of predators. So, which basically means that there is nothing, there's no restrictions on it at all. If you see a wolf and you're driving down the road, you can, you know, bail out of your car and shoot them anywhere, anytime of the year.
Is there public access or as free as BLM?
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's on federal land or just private land or whatever. I mean, you know, if you're out...
Is it a free-for-all? Yeah.
Yeah, if you're in the national forest, you know, in around Lander, for example, or something, and you see a wolf, you can shoot it and kill it. There's no restrictions on it. There's not even any restrictions on the methods that you can use. And you can, it's similar to what, you know, Montana and what we're seeing there. It's, you know, you can trap them out there. You can, you know, poison them. You can, I mean, all kinds of things happen. Yeah. It's just a free for all, basically.
There's a tagging system or no, you need a tag or you don't need a tag.
Absolutely. No, no license, no tag, nothing. So the only, the only place that you need an actual tag is in the trophy game management area. And it's two per person. There's quotas. So they sell as many tags, you know, there could be 1,000 tags sold. And they close the areas once the quotas are met. So there's different hunting units that are surrounding the national parks, and there's no buffer zone between the parks and these hunting units. So anytime, and of course, you know, for September 15th, our snow starts falling here usually in late September and October, and wolves are much easier to track in the winter. So they're hunted pretty readily in these areas.
So wait a minute. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around the numbers too, because I went to the International Wolf Symposium, and Wyoming, I think Fish and Game was there. They were talking about the management style. So do you know off, just if you have a roundabout number, I mean, the population of wolves in the state of Wyoming, and for those who are listening, and Kristen, if you know this, and correct me if I'm wrong, this includes the Yellowstone population. So from what I understand, the population of wolves in Wyoming is roughly 160, maybe 165. I think that's the number that they try to keep it in and around. Is that an accurate depiction of how they manage them? Because clearly if it gets up anywhere above that number, like you say, it's a free for all. Like, is there a number they need to keep? What's the deal with that situation?
Yes. So Wyoming is mandated by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to have 150 wolves and 15 breeding pairs. So that is the bare minimum that they have to keep in order to prevent them from going back under the endangered species list protections. So Yellowstone itself gets 5 breeding pairs and 100 wolves. So that's kind of like, or 50 wolves, I'm sorry, 50 wolves and 5 breeding pairs. And then the rest of the state can have, you know, this 100 number and the other 10 breeding pairs. So there's roughly during the year about 300-ish wolves, you know, with Yellowstone and Grand Teton and the trophy game management area. And there are packs that do exist in the predator zone, but they just don't persist there very long, and they're pretty fractured and broken. We are starting to see some packs move into the Wind River Reservation, which is just kind of southeast of Yellowstone National Park, down into the Wind River Range. And that we're starting to see some, like, a little bit of, like, more protection there. They actually do have a hunting season on the reservation, but since they've instituted it, no wolves have ever been taken. So or have ever been killed there. You've got about 300 wolves in the state, and every year about half of them are killed, either through the trophy game management area, or, you know, they give out predator depredation tags to. So if you're a rancher that ranches inside the trophy game management area, you can apply for a depredation tag, you know, if a wolf kills one of your cows or something, and then you are, you're free to take that wolf at the, you know, to kill that wolf at that time.
Unlimited depredation tags?
Yeah, I've never seen a limit put on those.
I was reading one of your articles, you mentioned explosives in the list of legal hunting methods. I have never heard of that. How are explosives used on wolves?
So what usually happens is they find a den site and just blow it up. And that, I mean, there's something, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's called denning. And that's just a, you know, a euphemism going in and killing pups in a den. Sometimes, you know, like cyanide gas is used, and other times, they just drag the pups out and kill them. So
how are explosives considered fair chase hunting? That's on another planet.
Well, and so here's what the state would argue. The state would argue that, well, this isn't hunting because they're listed as a predator. So basically this species, there's so many of them that, you know, like, it just doesn't matter. It's how they think about coyotes too. It's like, oh, there's no worry about their population, and they're a pest and a nuisance.
Native species.
So kill as many as you want.
Native species. That's mind-blowing.
Yes, all of the animals that are listed on the predator list are native except for stray cats.
Native species, man.
I've heard of denning. I never thought that they would use
It doesn't happen frequently, but sure. It definitely, I mean, it's allowed.
Well, the fact that it's allowed
is
enough.
There's nothing that says that you can't do that.
Yeah. It's allowed is nuts. And you're talking about gas, too. I mean, the ramifications of those things, we've talked about this with Montana, too. It's the same thing. You're, you know, poison baiting, snaring, any of those things has an adverse effect for everything else that's out on the landscape, including humans, pets, dogs. I mean, people have, I'm sure by now, seen the thing that happened with that husky up in, I think that was
Montana. The husky that was mistaken for a wolf.
You know, those huskies that were released and then mistaken for a wolf, which I don't know how you can do that. So this is all considered legal, obviously, under the law. I mean, how do they keep track of the 150 though at this point? Because if that's such a close and narrow, and Wyoming's a big state, the fact that there's only allowable 150, and most of those wolves are going to be in Yellowstone, because that's they're very smart. They know that up there, at least there's protection. There's plenty of game, things like that. So you're talking about the rest of the state, you know, even if you have 100 wolves, the rest of the state, it's not a lot. I mean, the circle doesn't square there for me. How are they keeping track of the number to make sure that, one, they're not going underneath, because that is a very narrow focus. if you're saying, okay, it's at 300, we're going to kill exactly half or as close to half as possible, how's the management plan working? How are they keeping track of this stuff?
And so they do have quite a few wolves that are collared. Wyoming, so wolves were delisted here in 2017. Mm-hmm. This is actually the final year that they, you know, like are required to keep close track of the numbers to make sure that they're staying, you know, quote unquote recovered. I have spoken with the wolf manager here at the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, and he said that he will continue to track them because that's the only way that they can know how many there are. Because they do, you know, are so they're writing, they do allow. Okay, so the department does say, well, we're going to shoot for 160. We're going to add in an extra 10 there for a buffer. And that's the number that they, like, you know, are targeted at. And of course, some of the commissioners would love for it to be lower. They would, you know, they would be happy if it was 100 or 50. And you're right. This is an enormously humongous state. This state is so big. There's so much wilderness. We're the leastly populated state in the entire country. We have more cows and pronghorn than we do people. And yet somehow, you know, they act like wolves are totally overrun. So the management plan that's put in place is by design to keep wolves in and around Yellowstone and Grand Teton and in the northwest corner of the state and not anywhere else. And we see that the minute the wolves leave this trophy game management area or either of the parks, you know, usually they end up dead. The packs that persist in the sort of in the predator zone in, you know, toward the northwest corner of the state are just really hard to, I mean, they just get fragmented all the time and broken up because, you know, an entire pack could be wiped out for cattle depredations.
Wow. You mentioned in this article too that you feel that wolves are far from full recovery. How do you define full recovery?
If you look at our state and the ecosystem, if you were just to look at Wyoming from an ecological standpoint, we have some of the sickest deer and elk in the country. Our elk and deer are just riddled with disease. There's hoof rot, we have feed grounds, which is crazy. We feed the elk in the winter, which breeds disease. They have chronic wasting disease. They have brucellosis. There's just a flurry of ailments that, you know, are within our elk and deer herds. Mule deer are on the decline. And all of, like, if you just look at like the crux of like what creates a healthy herd, apex predators are the thing that they need. Like if you are an elk advocate, you should also be a wolf or a mountain lion or a grizzly bear advocate because those two things need each other. They, you know, that is the system that was set up before we were here. And that's the system that keeps healthy populations of both going strong. And so, I mean, when we see that in like the northern elk herd in Yellowstone, I mean, people, you know, one of the problems is that the time period that we had where we didn't have wolves and grizzly bears on the landscape, people got used to these really highly inflated numbers of deer and elk. And that became like the normal. And so now that populations are starting to like get back to normal, for example, in that northern Yellowstone elk herd, because you have a robust population of wolves up there, or you did before last year, that herd they're the healthiest in the country by far. I mean, they wolves, you know, just target in and call out the weak and sick and can see it long before we can, especially with something like chronic wasting disease. Wolves can pick up on that in, you know, years before humans can see outward symptoms of it. So, you know, the rest of the state, we just have very unhealthy, unbalanced ecosystems. And I think that is a good measure, is like, you know, looking at, if we have proper recovery, then we would see healthy elk herds and deer herds in other parts of the state. We would see tourism and economic benefits in other parts of the state. But instead, it's sort of this wasteland of, you know, diseased deer and elk and unbalanced ecosystems that are suffering because of it.
Yeah, I was going to ask about tourism in a second, but another question came up. You said there are feed grounds for deer as like a state management practice, or why?
Yeah, so there, yes, for elk, there are feed grounds. So deer, I mean, do find their way onto them, but in general, it's just for elk. Yeah, and that is a state management practice in order to mainly keep elk separated from cattle because of this disease called brucellosis, and to keep an unnaturally high population of elk so that outfitters can charge people to come and hunt them.
Yeah.
That is another reason that these feed grounds exist. And it's just if you put 20 people into a tiny room that are, you know, there's five people in there that are sick, everyone's going to get sick. The density is the problem there. You have all these elk that are tightly clustered, and disease is just really easy to spread amongst that.
Right. Is the correlation, because this is, and Stephen, I know you want to talk about tourism, and I do too, really, really quick, but this is, I think, the third person from a third different state that has, one, said that elk hunting's never been better, the populations have never been bigger, better, and they're, you know, game for hunting, for sustenance hunting and things of that sort. Two, are you guys trying to make the correlation to these individuals or groups, just like you were making with us, about balancing out these herds and understanding that the disease hurts your bottom line as well? Because let's face it, and again, I keep saying this and I want to keep reading it, I am not a hunter, I don't go out and hunt and things like that. However, no person in their right mind is, one, going to shoot a sick looking elk. They can't eat that elk, or it's not recommended. I know they haven't had any correlation between CWD, at least. I don't know about these other diseases transferred to humans, but that's going to hurt somebody's bottom line, because if you pay X amount of dollars, you go out, you shoot an elk, and it comes back and it's sick, or it's dying, or it's not healthy, that's going to hurt your bottom dollar. Does that correlation ever come across for them, or is it still just, we just want to have the numbers so that we have, and I can understand them from a business standpoint saying, if I have the numbers, I know I can bring my group out and they're going to get an elk. And that may be just the bottom line. So is there a loss in translation there for them in terms of that? I'm not understanding that, hey, we need healthy herds. There may be less of them, but there'll be a better elk, as opposed to just numbers and you get what you get.
That is a very difficult point for somebody to understand, especially as we were saying before, this place of values is where they're coming from. And so, you know, their dad and their grandfather and generally wolves are bad. We want more. We want more of the prey, you know. It's kind of like goes back to Aldo Leopold, you know, sort of realizing that like the view from the mountain is not the same as the human's view. And so I think, you know, like the lack of predators is not a hunter's paradise. And I think that's really, really difficult for people to understand and see. The more of this like systems-based thinking rather than individual animal-based thinking. And yeah, I mean, because that's our main argument with feed grounds too, is like, if you continue to do this practice, you're going to have way less elk, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, because chronic wasting disease is going to take hold. And then we're really going to see declines in these species. But trying to explain that to someone who has always gone out and hunted and they've always seen this, you know, herd of elk in this place, and now they don't see them there anymore, or, you know, they think that there's fewer, it's like anecdotal evidence versus science evidence. And I mean, we're a very social species as humans, and I think that we listen to that anecdotal evidence more than we do science. Science just doesn't, it's not a language that most people are used to hearing. And so I think that it's a hard argument for people to understand that why and how keystone and apex predators are important to the herd of the health of a herd.
I think this brings us into talking about how killing wolves costs the state revenue. And you're obviously talking about sort of this long game where sicker herds means, you know, less opportunity for outfitters and hunters, et cetera. But in more shorter terms, how does killing wolves cost the state revenue?
Yeah, I mean, the main if you ask people, you know, what do you want to see when you come to Jackson and Grand Teton and Yellowstone? Wolves and grizzlies. I mean, you know, wolves and bears. There is, those are the things that you can't see other places. You have to come here to this place. And a lot of people do come here to this place from all over the world to see them. And we have an enormous economic benefit because of that here in Jackson and in the northwest corner of the state. The rest of the state could also be benefiting from that. I mean, Wyoming is seeing young people leaving in droves because there's no opportunity here. There's no business here. We, for decades, have been talking about how do we diversify the economy. And yet, you know, there's this like golden goose that we've seen that does diversify the economy and bring in dollars, tourism dollars. And they're just like the stubbornness of people won't let that happen. I mean, if you, Lander is like the number one place that I could see where you could have like an amazing wolf watching community there. I mean, right now it's a pretty good sized climbing community and a lot of people go there for outdoor recreation, but the Wind Rivers are right there. You could have a pretty robust wolf population too and have great wolf watching opportunities. I mean, anywhere that wolves exist in the world, you do have these, you know, communities of wolf watchers that go and watch them. And they're spending money along the way. And people are going to Yellowstone and they're also, most of them are driving. So they're also visiting towns across the state, you know, spending money on the way there. I just don't know, like, you know, Wyoming is just so stubborn about it that they just can't see that this is something that we should take advantage of rather than, you know, wolves are our allies. They're not our enemies here. That is just the bottom line. And it really is these just like culturally ingrained agricultural values that exist here. That agriculture is a very small part of our economy. Tourism is the second biggest thing behind oil and gas development. So, we know what we need to do. Like Wyoming knows they need to get on the ball and we've got to make money somehow, especially as, you know, coal is dying and we have less oil and gas, you know, necessary in the world. So, it's just foolishness and stubbornness about taking advantage of something that could be a huge plus to the state.
And what about outfitting? Where does that fall on the scale of economic value in Wyoming?
Yeah, I mean, you can't discount it and say it's not an economic value. It for sure is. I mean, we do have people that come here to hunt elk and bighorn sheep and mountain goats and all kinds of other species. However, that can exist alongside wolf watching.
Right.
It's not mutually exclusive of each other. And that is the big problem is like people think that you can't have both, but you can.
I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of folks that would pay more to be on a landscape that was fully intact hunting elk rather than, you know, some kind of wild farming situation, which sometimes it feels that way.
Yeah, exactly. And that is pretty much what Northwest Wyoming is right now, is like it's a game farm. I mean, we feed the elk. There's plenty of that. There's, you know, like way more than there needs to be. We're 30% over objective across the entire state for elk. So, yeah, it's like there's plenty of elk to go around for everybody. And so, like you said earlier, John, like there's only 150 to 300 wolves at a time in this state. Like we're not talking about, you know, tens of thousands of them. It's such a small number and they really don't have as much of an impact as, you know, people make it seem like they do.
If you're 30% over elk objectives, aren't ranchers having issues with that?
Right.
I mean, in terms of...
Yes. And every year, the Wyoming Game and Fish Department has to pay out depredation payments for...
That's the part
elk
I'm confused about.
Hay stores.
It's like, if these numbers are so over... I mean, 30% is a large number. That's what I'm saying. When you... And I know we're all on the same page here, I think, in this... Anybody who's listening too. But just if you understand the narrow scope of what you're trying to do to control and manage a predator population like wolves, and you have such a slim margin for error, whereas your prey number is so high above board and or above the limit that it should be, it only is going to invite those diseases, the overcrowding, your cattle grazers are going to get, because we've had people on here that have said that, where, you know, the elk are coming on, they're eating the hay, there's too many of them, I can't get them off my land. And, you know, so that costs them more money to get more hay to feed their cattle, which then drives up the price. It's just this whole domino effect. Why is the Fish and Game Department not concerned as much? Why are they willing to pay out money for a species that could be managed easier and probably cost less money than a predator species?
Yeah.
If you have that answer.
A culture, you know, culture. I mean, it's not biology. It's not biology. That is the thing that you got to like just keep remembering, is that biology is not driving these decisions. If it was, then we would see robust wolf populations and mountain lion populations and even grizzly bears in other parts of the state. But since politics is at play here, wolves are not allowed to persist anywhere else. And so, yeah, it's like this free service. There is, I mean, right now there is millions of dollars being pumped into chronic waste and disease management solutions. I don't know what you want to call them. They're not really solutions, because we have the solution already. It's called wolves and coursing predators like mountain lions. Those are the things that, and if you look across the country at places where there's a little bit of a hole for CWD, usually it's where wolves exist. You know, we don't really have it very strong right now in Yellowstone. If you look at like northern Minnesota and Wisconsin, also wolves there. CWD isn't that bad there. And it's going to be really interesting to see, because we're kind of on this trajectory that we can't turn back from with chronic waste and disease. I think it's going to sweep through Yellowstone eventually, because we have these feed grounds running and there's no plan to close them or phase them out anytime soon. So it's going to be interesting to see, like, do we end up with this hole where Yellowstone is, that chronic waste and disease is not a problem? I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's so simple at a biological level. It's so complex at a political level, I guess, is like, that's the big difference here, is that that's what we're talking about, modernizing wildlife management. You know, not only do you need to use biology and ecology, but you also got to look at human values, and you've got to look at what are the social sciences that go in behind. I mean, as a whole, the American public disagrees with trophy hunting. I mean, to some, like, you know, 80% of people disagree with trophy hunting. Hunting wolves and bears is only trophy hunting. So as a society, we've said already, we don't want that. But yet, you know, these states just keep pushing that as the agenda. And this is what we're going to do. This is what we've always done. Of course, you're going to hunt them. Why wouldn't you? And they just can't see anything other than that.
Yeah. And thank you for identifying, though, because I'm glad Stephen asked that question earlier about the trophy game management area and the predator zone. Because as we've discussed a couple of times recently, actually, is, and especially with the Colorado reintroduction coming, Wyoming, in a sense, is really this black hole where for wolves to make it across the state to get into Colorado naturally, even from Montana and things like that, it's very, very rare. I know there are some wolves there in Colorado at the moment, maybe a pack, maybe two. I mean, small numbers. It just... What is the public perception? Stephen probably, I think he did ask this, but with your group, what's the public perception of, I guess, wolves in general, bear, like of apex predators? Because you guys do a lot of the work with them. What are they? Do they enjoy these animals on the landscape? Do they lean more towards the prey and elk? I don't know if that's something that's been studied by you guys or researched by you guys. Is there a love for these animals? And it's, like you say, not understanding fully informationally what the state organizations are doing to manage these species.
I think that is a lot of it. I think there are a fair number of people in Wyoming that love wildlife, all wildlife. I mean, that's another thing, is like, wolves are not considered wildlife. Like, people will say, I'm protecting the wildlife by killing wolves. Like, That is the mindset here. So, you know, it's, and people believe that. I'm like, oh, okay, well, there's this guy out there that is, you know, he's out there every weekend hunting wolves and coyotes, and he's keeping our ranchers safe, and he's protecting the deer and the elk. And that is legitimately how some people see it. You know, it's like there's this like kind of like a hero story there about, you know, this guy is the protector of the community. But I will say that, I mean, I've been all over the state. I've met people from every corner, and there are people all over the state that love all wildlife and love wolves and love bears and understand their place in the ecosystem and want to see them. I think that there is just this trust, this like misguided trust in the Game and Fish Department of like, oh, they're the experts. They know what they're doing. You know, we're just going to let them do what they're going to do because I'm just a citizen. I don't know any better. And if you look at the people that actually are involved in wildlife management here, it's either people in agriculture, people in the outfitting industry and guiding industry, the legislators and advocates. Like, those are the people. Your average everyday Joe person is not involved in wildlife management in the state. And so, you know, like our commission, for example, is all hunters and have historically been people that have been in the ranching industry that have a financial windfall from harshly controlling, you know, predator populations. And agriculture just still really runs this place. And I mean, I think you see that in Montana and Idaho too. It's that is really just like the guiding thinking and thought process that leaves us to where we are now, where there's still this very like stern mindset of, you know, we got it. You know, wolves are bad. Wolves are bad. They're going to eat my sheep. They're going to eat my cows. And, you know, there's nothing else I can do. We just got to shoot them, which just sets into this. You're just recycling conflict, basically. You know, there's no right. Resolution there. And you're so right. I do want to touch on that point that you made about Wyoming is a black hole. Any wolf that tries to disperse ends up dead. I mean, there's no way you're going to make it from, and there's been a few wolves. I mean, like there's been like three wolves. One went to South Dakota. One went to the Grand Canyon. I think one went to Utah. Like, and they did get killed elsewhere. But yeah, even those wolves in Colorado, the minute they stepped over the Wyoming border, they're dead. And so, you know, I have mixed feelings about the reintroduction in Colorado. I, you know, do I want to see wolves back in Colorado? 100%, yes. But I really fear for what's going to happen to those wolves that live close to the border and do make their way into, I mean, they will end up dead. They will just be dead. There's no other if, ands, or buts about it.
So do you agree with the argument for why we had to initiate reintroduction into Colorado is because they probably would never make it through Wyoming? Does that sound like just an impossible feat?
Yes, 100%. I mean, you know, for all consequences and intents here, like wolves have been reintroduced since 1995, and we've seen, yeah, none make it to Colorado. So 100%, yes, there's no way they would naturally repopulate there just because Wyoming is so harsh. And I mean, people, it's like a hobby on the weekend. You go out and shoot coyotes here. That's what you do. So for a wolf to make it all the way to Colorado is almost impossible.
Is there any legislation, lawsuits, anything like that coming to the state? And I don't know. I'm wondering, because there are a lot of these nonprofits and a lot of these organizations that are trying to also end the game, you know, the game contests and the wildlife shooting contests and things like that, mostly with coyotes. A lot of them have, like you were saying, if it's a weekend activity that people just go out and shoot as much wildlife as they can. And it's just sort of a contest thing or whatever it is. Is there any room to change it for the, again, I keep going back to the public. It seems like they don't. And again, I could be wrong, and I'm hoping for someone to reach out to us and tell me different, but it doesn't seem that the legislative bodies want the general public to voice their opinions if they have them about these situations, because it seems to be just littered as a power and a money situation to run the state. I don't know if you feel that way or if
that's
how that's going.
One of the problems is we have a part-time legislature here and it's only in session for January, February, and March. So that kind of sets up a situation where you can only have a very specific type of person that can take 3 months out of their life to serve the public. And we have a large amount of ranchers in our legislature. You know, ranchers, lawyers, some business people, but not very many. So agriculture predominantly still rules the legislature here. And the times that we have tried to bring even a conversation about, you know, like during an interim committee meeting to talk about what kind of bills we would want to see, it just devolves into this argument about one of our longtime legislators, you know, basically just said, I'll take my predators any way I want. Like, you're not going to tell me how and, you know, how I can't kill things that are threatening my livestock. So the public is just very much shut out of the process. Yes. And I've gone to countless Wyoming Game and Fish Commission meetings. It's, you know, it's a 7-person panel that is appointed by the governor. They give me my 2 minutes and then, you know, ignore me and go, I'm on my way. Like there's no chance for a good conversation. You don't have the chance to even rebut what they say after you speak. It's not a dialogue. It's not meaningful public input. It's just, you get up there and you say your piece and then they ignore you and you move on. And that is like a fundamental problem with the fact that and they have the final say in everything. And so every year the wolf hunting quotas come up for like review. And during that time, a lot of people comment and say, you know, we don't want to see wolf hunting. Like, we no more wolf hunting in Wyoming. And they'll tell you, well, now we're not talking about that now. Like, that this isn't the time for that. We're only focused on the quotas. And so it's like, well, when is the time to talk about it? When can I voice my opinion about that? When can I have any say in the process? Because the commission it's like as if you put me on the board of the American Medical Association. I would not know enough about what people were, you know, these experts would come in, let's just say doctors would come in and explain something to me. I wouldn't know enough about it to be able to like critique it properly or like really, you know, think about what they're trying to say or like, you know, what even just provide any dissent. I would just be like, wow, that person's an expert. They know what they're talking about. Seems legit to me, you know, rubber stamp. And that is the same right way that our commission is. It's not people that have any like biology background or science background or any kind of like, you know, they're not able to look at it with a critical eye. So the biologists come, you know, they say, here's the reason that we're setting these seasons. Here's the quotas that we have. Seems legit to the commissioners, you know, and they're the ones with the final say. They could be the ones to say, no, actually, I think, you know, that unit seems like it needs to have probably a quota of one or, you know. Or why don't we not have hunting this year? Because there's, you know, there's been less wolves there. That never happens. There's no opportunity for dissent. It's just, you know, here's the thing and here's the quotas and let's move on.
I mean, I will say this before I ask you the last question here, Kristen, is that I did see there was another letter to the editor just earlier this month. And it was, interestingly enough, Stephen and I talked with someone from Colorado, with Nick Jivak, who was talking about these specific things about privatization of public lands for hunting and things of that sort. And that letter of the editor really goes into that. I'm wondering if this is what it will take for people to, once it hits their backyard necessarily, because if things start to encroach on now the outfitting, the sportsman people, that could be the allies that you all need, because if they start coming to your side and then you'll have more of that. I mean, I don't know if you see any of that floating or any of that stuff happening, but the fact that it was an open letter to the editor from sports people saying like, you've supported us in the past, but now if you start making these privatized lands where we can't go on, we can't afford it theoretically, because we're talking tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, they're cannibalizing.
That's going to be a major concern for them
eventually.
So. Yeah, we are seeing a little bit of that here. I think that's particularly an issue that's going to come up with the feed grounds, because the department, we brought some lawsuits that have been successful against the Forest Service for allowing the permitting of these things. And I think you're going to start to see, so the Game and Fish Department is very much in talks already with trying to, okay, well, if we can't have them on federal land anymore, we need to find some private land to put them on. And so I'm curious to see what happens with that. And then also very similar to what's happening in Montana, where they're going to start paying people to have elk on their property, or allowing elk to be on their property in the winter, or you are going to, I'm going to give you, six tags for elk because you're going to allow so many to be on your property in the winter. That very much is the privatization of wildlife. And yeah, that's not going to fly for sure with, just Joe Sportsman in Wyoming. And there's been battles for many years over allocation of non-resident hunting tags versus resident hunting tags. And that's something that always comes into play. So, yeah, I mean, it makes for strange bedfellows sometimes when you know, it's kind of a means to an end. And until we see some sportsmen that are really going to strongly come out and support the existence of large carnivores on the landscape, I think it's going to continue to be a battle. And really, yeah. I mean, just being truthfully honest, federal action is probably the only thing that will make change happen in Wyoming right now, just because we're just far back. It's 1850 here in a lot of places, and it's just that we're just not in a place where we are ready to move into the 21st century with wildlife management and really think about looking at systems versus individual populations of animals.
Yeah, I think once they start privatizing more and more of these hunting opportunities, the blue collar hunter that I think makes up the majority of the hunting population that have had generations of hunters in their family are going to be leaning, the other way on this issue, because they're going to be the most affected and excluded because of these types of practices. And I just can't understand how we aren't seeing far enough ahead to see that happening.
It's just so short-sighted. And feed grounds are short-sighted, and shooting wolves is short-sighted, and killing grizzly bears is short-sighted. All of this stuff is really short-sighted. And yeah, it is. It's, we need to start thinking ahead to, 20 to 50 years down the road versus just what's happening right now. And I will say this. I have a lot of friends who hunt, to fill their freezer. They go out and they get one elk and they're one deer for the season. They eat it. They eat the meat. They are the ones that we're not hearing from. Like those, I have tons of friends who are hunters.
And that's most of them.
Yes, exactly. That is the majority that understand the importance of wildlife, of all wildlife on the landscape, and having wolves and bears as part of that, and apex predators. It's the people. There's just this like very narrow segment of these hunting groups that have enormous amounts of money, that those are the voices we hear from. And we don't get a chance to hear from these other people who truly value the ecosystem as a whole and are not just narrowly focused on, how many elk are on the landscape.
Yeah, and I don't think people know how expensive we're talking here. I mean, it's going to be thousands and thousands of dollars for some of these private opportunities. It already happens in a lot of places. Most of us are not going to be able to afford those types of opportunities. Like you said, it's really short-sighted. I mean, these feedlots are honestly concerning me as well, just as like an overall
Well, it's a health issue. It's not great. Not at all.
There is a very famous photo from one of these feed grounds. There was a wolf pack that one night went in and killed, I think, 19 elk. There's a very specific type of biology that covers this sort of like predator response. When there's a very tightly packed herd of animals, oftentimes predators will kill several if they can, so that they can return and eat them, over the course of several weeks. Well, the Game and Fish Department went the next day, lined those elk up into a line and took a photo of them. And that one photo still, I just see it all the time about like, look at what bloodthirsty killers these wolves are. And then they carted the carcasses away. I don't even know what happened to them. I don't even know if predators got to eat off of them. So, you know, it's like those kind of situations are like what people just keep going back to of like, you know, this anecdotal where like, oh, wolves are going into the feed grounds and they're killing all these elk. And, you know, they're just these bloodthirsty killers. And but people just don't understand the value that they really do have, and that they are truly our allies. They are just our allies in everything. And if you love your dog, you should love a wolf. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I wish I could go back 20 years and study social science. I've gotten more into it, and I've been studying a lot more about psychology because I'm just fascinated as to like, how do people get to where they think something so strongly when there's so much scientific evidence against it? And the, you know, like that to me is just really boggles my mind. But once again, you know, it's values and it's culture, and there's so many other factors that go into wildlife management other than just biology and ecology.
Yeah. And judging wolves for how they hunt is like one of the most disappointing things to me that hunters and ranchers can do. I mean, these are, you know, these are folks that they experience the things that the rest of us don't. They know where stuff comes from. They know how things are made. And then somehow there's this judgment of how wolves kill. And then it's ironic that, you know, we're calling them these bloodthirsty predators because they're killing the same animals that we're after.
I don't know, man. And then you look at then you look at what's legal to kill them. You're talking about putting explosives into putting explosives into a baby's den. You know,
when wolves start blowing stuff up, then we'll talk about it. Then we'll talk about it.
Yeah. I don't think we have to worry about that. I don't think, but boy, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. We have to look ourselves in the mirror for some of these things and we don't.
That's what
enough.
We gotta do.
Definitely. It's very unsportsmanlike and it's very unfair and it's not fair chase hunting and it's not hunting. I mean, it's just not. That's, you know, my friends that hunt, they are true hunters. These people that are out there just blasting every wolf they see, that's not hunting.
No, not at all. Krista, my final question for you is, when you hear the word wolf, what's the thing that comes to your mind?
There's so much that comes into my mind when I hear that word, but really I think the two that stand out for me are ally and friend, because we are so similar to wolves. Our social structure is very similar to their social structure. We have brought them into our homes. We have made them our pets. We have relied on them for tens of thousands of years, and they provide so many services to the places that they exist. And so, yeah, I mean, I love seeing them. I never stop getting excited when I see a wolf in the wild. I'm sad that I can no longer see wolves in Grand Teton National Park frequently. It's disappointing that I can no longer go to Yellowstone and even see wolves in the same places. And so, yeah, I'm a touch of sadness in there too, I think, just with the adversity that wolves are up against, and for no reason, basically, for very, very silly reasons that are part of our culture and don't have anything to do with what's really happening on the ground. So I love wolves because of what they are and what they stand for. And, you know, just they've been there with us, you know, the whole way through, like since humans have been here in this continent. They've been our companions. And why people can't see that, I don't know.
Mm. Hopefully the future is better with people like you. Obviously it helps. Kristen Combs, thank you so much for informing us on Wyoming. And if anything else comes down the pike, you let us know and we'll get you back on so we can talk about it. Kristen Combs from Wyoming Wildlife Advocates, thank you so much.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you guys so much for doing what you do and for highlighting the issues around wolves, because the more people that know, the more people that hopefully will care and take action. So thank you for being here and trying to get the word out to people.
No problem. Thanks so much. Hal Steele out there, and we'll be with you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Looking to support Wolf Connection or sponsor one of the wolves in our pack? Just go to wolfconnection.org, click on the donate tab, and find out more information.